Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the world of economics and politics. Two guests up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from the labor journalist and historian Dan Labatz about the quiescence of the U.S. working class, despite the deepest and most intractable recession since the 1930s. And at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from another historian, this one Stephanie Kuntz, on family life yesterday and today. First, a few words of the news. This week brought us some outlines of the president's budget proposals to be released in detail on February 1st and his State of the Union address. The politics of it all are rather confused and confusing. On the one hand, the White House has been assuring us, and the pundits have been amplifying the message, that after the Republican victory in the Massachusetts Senate election, Obama is making a hard pivot towards jobs. Sounds not so bad. But how does he go about this? With a dose of austerity to start with. Early in the week, we learned that Obama will propose a 3-year freeze in domestic civilian discretionary spending. The Pentagon will, of course, be allowed to flourish. For the moment, entitlement programs, which are mandatory according to current law, the opposite in budget speak from discretionary, which has to be appropriated every year by Congress, these programs like Medicare and Social Security will be spared. But much of the good stuff that the government does, nutrition, environment, education, will be squeezed. Though it's impossible to find any details on the White House website, administration officials brag to the press that this will bring down this category of spending to its lowest share of GDP in 50 years. Joe Biden's chief economic advisor, Jared Bernstein, an occasional guest in this show in the past years, went on the Maddow show the other day to say that this isn't as bad as it looks. It's just a small part of the budget, and under the surface, only bad programs will suffer, not good ones. It was depressing to see Bernstein say these things. I remember him as a good guy when we served together on the steering committee of the Union for Radical Political Economics. His academic background is actually in social work, not the dismal science. Before joining the administration, he worked for the Economic Policy Institute, an excellent left-leaning think tank in D.C. In other words, Bernstein is someone who should know better than to spout devious apologetics. But here he was covering the president's left flank on MSNBC. Thankfully, Maddow expertly gave him a very hard time. Bernstein's apologetics were contradicted by an anonymous administration official who told the New York Times that this freeze was intended only as a first step and to build political support for an attack on entitlements, meaning Medicare, Medicaid, and it wouldn't surprise me at all, Social Security as well. All along, the president's men and women have said that they don't want to repeat the mistake of 1937 when, pressed by fiscal hawks, the Roosevelt administration cut spending and threw the economy, which had been recovering for 3 years, back into depression. But it looks like they're planning to do exactly that. And then the State of the Union, a very Clintonian marriage of high-flown rhetoric about reinvention and renewal to minimal actual programs. He talked about green jobs and clean energy, but there's no way any of that can happen without gobs of public spending and state coercion. And he bragged about tax cuts. It's clear that the ghost of Ronald Reagan is still in charge of our national political discourse. And if things keep going the way they've been going, the hardcore right will soon be replacing the softcore right that's now in power. It's all rather depressing, really. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about the working class.
Thank you.
That was this week's dose of Beethoven piano sonatas, this the second movement of number 30, performed by Alfred Brendel. My first guest today is Dan Labatz. Labatz is a historian and labor journalist based in Cincinnati. He has a piece in the winter 2010 issue of New Politics called Whatever Happened to the American Working Class? I thought that was a good question, and so were his answers. So I gave him a call. Here's Dan Labatz speaking on a cell phone from one of his three jobs. Three jobs, that's one of the things that's happened to the American working class, isn't it? Those, that is, who are lucky enough to have even one. Dan Labatz. Welcome, Dan. I think given the scope of the economic crisis we've been through the last couple of years, a lot of people across the political spectrum were expecting some kind of New Deal-ish upsurge, a real political transformation at the state level, but also some labor militancy, some kind of protest, formal or informal. We've seen little or none of that. We've seen, an attempt to restore the status quo ante at the state level, and the only popular upsurge coming from the right in the form of people wearing tea bags in their heads. Let's try to analyze why that might be, and let's just start by going back to the 30s. Give us a refresher on the political environment of the 1930s and how it was different from the present.
Well, I think one of the big differences had to do just in demographic and economic terms, that you had a much larger industrial working class in that period, that is, people who worked in factories and people who worked in heavy industry, and a whole immigrant group that had, by then, because of the closing off of immigration from Europe, had a couple of decades to assimilate to American culture, and it's become a new working class in the United States, still not completely integrated into the society, but much more so than they had been. Politically, I think you had a much stronger left. Of course, despite the repeated kind of waves of anti-communism and anti-socialism and repression by government and employers, you know, there was a long history of a socialist movement. There was, in the 1930s, a communist movement. There were smaller groups like the Trotskyists and so on. There was a left in the United States that was small but had a long tradition, had very dedicated people who were working in the labor movement. That was another big factor, I think. And we also had in that period, a large number of people working in agriculture on family farms who had inherited also an agrarian radical tradition, agrarian populism, so that we found in the 1930s workers turning towards industrial unionism, but we also found sometimes among farmers people turning to take action in rural areas as well and organizing rural farmers organizations. So in the 1930s, I think the combination of the different character of the working class and the presence of a left that was in the working class were big factors on what happened in the organization of the big industrial unions in the 1930s, and then that becoming a big factor in national politics, being able to influence the national political situation, influence the programs and policies that would have to be taken up by the major political parties than is now the Republicans and the Democrats.
How important was the Communist Party back in the 30s?
The Communist Party had come out of a strange period. Joseph Stalin, the head of the Communist International, had directed communists between 1928 and 1934 to build their own independent party and labor unions and not work with anybody else on the left and not work in the major AFL-CIO labor unions. And on the one hand, that had isolated the communists. On the other hand, they had come out of that period with about 7,000 very dedicated members. They had also done something that would prove to be key in the organization of the industrial unions and the building of the CIO. That is, they had been virtually the only group, perhaps except a handful of Quakers or something, who would really sit down in the same room and work with the African American people in their issues. And they had formed a relationship with African American industrial workers and black people in black communities in the United States. And the communists were virtually the only group that had done that during that period. And that would be key, because the great problem in the American working class historically had been divisions between white and black workers, and of course sometimes between white ethnic groups and so on. So the idea of being able to unify across the race line was really key. So though the communists were quite small, if we say 7,000 people, they had done something really important with those small numbers. They had built a really dedicated group of people in industry, in the unions, in urban centers, and in alliance with black people. That was really rare in that period.
7,000 people, it really doesn't take too many to make a big difference, does it?
Well, I think not. And of course, they weren't the only ones. The Socialist Party had thousands of members. The Trotskyists had a few hundred members. And all of these, and other small splinter groups with the names, you know, proletarian socialists and communists and so on, and a few remaining industrial workers of the world, people who were important in some areas. All of these leftists played a very important role in, and often, who were their allies in the workplace? Their allies in the workplace were the skilled workers. And we often forget that. It was the skilled workers, the most skilled workers, people like tool and die workers, who were key. They were protected by their high skills. Employers were reluctant to fire them because it was hard to find and replace somebody who had those tremendous skills and really knew your factory and your needs. And so those skilled workers were often the ones who were the leadership within the factory and helped to organize the unorganized. And they had also, as those skilled workers, they had the leverage, the economic leverage in the plant to make a difference. So I think that those couple of alliances, which we, you know, the bridges that the left formed, on the one hand, to the skilled workers, who tended not only to be white, but tended to be overwhelmingly Anglo-Saxon, tended to be real people of English descent, often people, recent immigrants from England sometimes, or Wales, and so on. And on the one hand, those skilled workers, and on the other hand, the African-American unskilled workers. And the left had those connections that made possible the building of a labor movement in the industrial working class.
There are several things that are impressive about that. One, the skilled workers did not retreat into their own bubble, but actually showed some solidarity with people below them in the economic ladder.
Well, I don't want to exaggerate that, of course. It would be a mistake to exaggerate that. That is, the AFL had organized craft unions. Most of these skilled workers were in those craft unions, but they had come to realize, often by dint of having their heads broken in strikes and having their unions smashed and losing their contracts, some of those skilled workers had come to realize they could not win unless they made an alliance with the Slavic immigrants, the Southern European immigrants, the Italians, and so on, with the African American workers. If they did not make an alliance with those people in lower echelons in society and in lower unskilled positions in the factory, they couldn't win, and they had come to realize that. But it would be a mistake to exaggerate. You know, the AFL-CIO was very racist, very exclusionist. Its leaders viewed the immigrant workers as well as the African-American workers as kind of rabble, they scum. I mean, sometimes you find words like that in their own speeches and writings. They looked down on those people, the leaders of the AFL. But in every factory, there were more politically conscious and more, let's say, humanistic thinking workers who saw themselves as part of a common humanity. And that was important.
Is there anything that we can learn today from the way the communists were able to work across the race line?
Well, I think we have a world of things to learn. And I would say there was the communists in that particular period. A little later, when the war starts, the communists are prepared to set aside the importance of the race issue because they can become committed to winning the war to save the Soviet Union. But are there things we can learn? Yes, I think that one of the things we can learn is that has to be a strategic outlook to establish a relationship with workers who are immigrant workers, who are African-American workers, in our society, Latino workers are so important. We've had this tremendous increase. Latino workers make up 14% of our working class. And, of course, some of these things come down to such basic things that any union has to learn to do, which is to operate in those communities, to make sure that meetings are conducted in languages that all the workers can understand, to publish union documents and literature. And most unions couldn't, 30 years ago when I was around unions, they didn't do that. They do it now because unions have come to recognize that these workers have to be an important and essential part of not only the membership, but they have to become part of the leadership. That has to be another thing. Unions have to have their own self-conscious program of affirmative action to advance people to leadership. I mean, that was, you know, the CIO formula for union leaders, in retrospect, seems kind of tokenistic or crude. That is, there was a general rule, the president would be a white person and the vice president would be a black person anywhere there were any blacks in the plant. And the communists fought for that kind of a formula, and the CIO picked that up as a formula. But it was such an enormous advance to say you'd have an African-American officer in the union as a regular, understood kind of rule of thumb. And I think that unions today have to, and also I think, again, unions have learned to do this, that advancing women to leadership roles, advancing Latinos and African-Americans, having a union that really reflects the workplace, and also understanding that those people who are immigrants or African-American workers or women workers or the gay, lesbian, transsexual, all the different groups in our society who suffer special oppressions, those workers also have a special insight into the nature of oppression and exploitation into the workplace because they live it. And if you can't incorporate their lived experience, you can't have a well-rounded understanding of what the working class is.
I'm speaking with the labor journalist Dan Labatz. I know if we can come to the present and try to explain the lack of activism, we can list, I think, several important things. One, McCarthyism. Two, deindustrialization. And three, mechanization, automation, computerization. Let's talk a little bit about each of those in turn, how they contributed to the demobilization of the American working class. And McCarthyism 50, 60 years ago, is it still leave its imprint today?
Well, I think it does. That is, I think the roots of McCarthyism were found in part in the fact that in World War II, the Democratic Party succeeded in drawing the communists and the socialists into its policy to win the war. And it, in that way, it separated the leaders of those unions from workers who very often during the war wanted to organize and fight for around conditions of wages on the shop floor and so on. And at the end of the war, the left was somewhat disoriented. And when McCarthyism came, the employers, the government and the employers and the press, the media, worked to remove the left from the unions. And they had a tremendous success. And they also worked where they couldn't break the union. They couldn't get rid of the communists in the union. They led to the splintering of the American labor movement. I mean, think of the case of electrical workers who had all been in the United Electrical Workers Union with a left leadership, a communist leadership in that union. And when McCarthyism comes along, it not only leads to the expelling of some of these unions in the AFL-CIO, rather in the CIO, there's no AFL-CIO yet, in the CIO, but it leads to the splintering so that the IBEW moves in to try to get workers, a much more conservative white craft union at that time. The UE splits into the left-led UE and the IUE, the International Union of Electrical Workers. And so the employers and the government are able to really weaken the ability of electrical workers to show power, to negotiate better contracts and so on, because they're in three different unions. And the left-led union is quickly reduced to a very small size, that is the UE. Whereas the IUE and the IBEW, more conservative unions, become the dominant force. So I always think that the electrical workers is a great example of what happened to left power. But I think more important, it ended a lot of those strategic ideas about struggle that had been in the heads and the experience of radical leadership there. It ended some of those strategies of an alliance between black and white workers, which had already begun to be diminished by the left itself during World War II. It reduced the notion of advancing workers in the union from minorities or women into positions of responsibility. So in many ways, it conservatized the labor movement very deeply.
Right now, deindustrialization in the 70s and 80s, how much of that was a conscious strategy in reaction to labor militancy, and how much of, you know, it's like the standard story is it was just we're suffering from foreign competition and we weren't up to the competitiveness of the Japanese and Germans. How much of it was this sort of naturalistic story of competition? How much of it was a conscious strategy to undermine militancy?
Well, I think it's fundamentally an economic issue. That is, the United States, which had been so dominant in the 1950s and 60s, faced a resurgent Japanese and German industrial production and and in German and Japanese capitalism. And those had been greenfield plants. Those were new plants built with the latest technology, whereas the sunk capital investment in old plants in the United States meant that those plants were not the most modern, were not the most efficient. And so consequently, you get to a certain point, as we all know, in the 1970s, where the auto plants in Michigan, the steel mills in Pennsylvania, all of those old industrial plants up in Connecticut and so on, those closed due to the foreign competition. Now, employers then can see the possibilities of using this as a weapon to say to the unions and to say to workers, if you don't give us what we want, we will be forced to move this plant overseas. And sometimes that was real, and sometimes that was just a club to be workers. It was a lie used as a club to be workers. I remember when during the NAFTA negotiation period and then the adoption of NAFTA, when NAFTA was first negotiated, many union organizer friends that I knew would tell me in their negotiations they were hearing, if you don't give us what we want, our plant will close and go to Mexico. And so you better give in. So I think it's fundamentally, at root, it was an economic issue. And also the employers, there were always two possibilities if you were going to compete. One was you were going to compete by moving your plant abroad, or two was you were going to change the technology in your plant and make your plant more efficient to compete with those overseas. In either case, it ends up reducing the number of industrial workers, and in both cases, it may reduce the power of industrial workers. Though if you actually industrialize your plant and the union could keep control of that plant and keep its role in the plant, it would have had greater possibilities. And there are some changes in technology which some have argued raised the possibility of greater working class power, such as just-in-time inventory and so on. But I'm not sure that that has proved to be the case in practice.
Well, let's talk a little more about automation and changes in the labor process in the last 20 or 30 years. It's not just a story of technology, it's also has an influence on consciousness and social relations. So how'd that change the way workers act and think?
Well, I think one of the things to think about is, over the years I've done a lot of reading and on the history of the Great Lakes area, maybe because I grew up in Chicago, and I used to be in Chicago and drive across those bridges and come in from the south side of Chicago when I was a kid, and you would see the great waterway there, the Calumet Seaway. You would see go up Torrance Avenue and see the steel mills and then the auto plants, and you would see all of American industrial production in Chicago, every piece of it. You could see where the iron ore came in, where the steel was made, and where the cars were built. But all of that, if you look at, if you go and read economic analyses and demographic, geographic analyses of the Great Lakes District, you find this incredibly dense web of railroads, of seaways. And that web was the web where the immigrants came in and settled. And those immigrant communities from Eastern Europe and from Southern Europe that formed the industrial working class of the 30s, and the skilled worker immigrants coming from England and Wales and so on, those people settled in there. And they were held together. That is, there was an actual economic, a kind of a net, a kind of, I don't know what the right analogy is, but it was a kind of a net that tied all of these groups together. Those communities had a lot of similarity, and the truck drivers drove back and forth between those communities, and the railroad workers went back and forth between them, and people migrated, and they had friends in the neighboring parts of northern Indiana, Michigan, Ohio. That formed a working class community. And in there, you found, of course, in every community, you found those same ethnic lodges, churches, community groups of all sorts, labor unions. And so those became the actual social, that was the social character of the American working class by those institutions laid over that economic organization. And in the consciousness is created by those two, I think. And that consciousness was sometimes quite ethnically parochial or religiously parochial. It could be conservative in many ways, but it also was a working class consciousness, always in struggle with the employers for a better life. Now, when you get deindustrialization and so on, you have factories and industries pulling up and moving to other parts of the country. And it seems to me it's like when you think of an operation, when you take an organ out of your body and you pull it out and you disconnect it from the rest of the systems and you move it someplace else. I mean, we have moved our plants and I'm reading the New York Times this morning about my own state of Ohio, where National Cash Register, NCR, as its modern name is, NCR is moving from Dayton to Atlanta. Well, that's exactly what's been happening, is these companies moving to Atlanta, moving to the Southwest, moving to the Northwest, spreading around the country, moving part of the plant to Mexico, moving part of the plant to China, moving part of the plant to Vietnam, so that the web of connections underlying the social institutions, and all of which form the context for working class consciousness, has been utterly transformed.
I believe last year the number of public sector union members surpassed the number of private sector union members. What does this do to the labor movement to have the public sector so dominant?
Well, on the one hand, it seems to me you have the fact that industrial workers had economic power in the workplace. And if they went on strike, that cost the boss money immediately. When public employee workers go on strike, it often saves their boss money immediately. That is, when school teachers go on strike, that money is not paid to them while they're on strike. When hospital workers, when government employees in city and county buildings. So the economic effect isn't there in the same way. So I think that creates a wholly different, it's economically weaker. There's no doubt about that, it seems to me. On the other hand, I've been a social worker. When I was a social worker in Chicago, our union had a good relationship to the union of the welfare recipients, as they were called at the time, with the welfare clients. And so you had relationships. I worked for a doctor's union in Chicago, and when I worked for that union, the doctors and the patients had a bond. And when we were fighting at Cook County Hospital to increase the budget there, we went out and mobilized the community to support those doctors who were willing to go on strike for that community. It was quite amazing. So you can have relationships that are socially and politically different in the service and the public sector. School teachers in Los Angeles, in the UTLA, that union has been a kind of a model of forming relationships between the union and the communities, the parents and students in those schools. So there's a trade-off, and it changes the nature of what it means to be a union, I think, when you're more in service and when you're more in the public sector.
Well, finally, having reviewed this history of a deindustrialized, fragmented, depoliticized, disempowered working class, it's kind of hard to imagine this turning around in the imaginable future. Am I being too pessimistic?
I think you're being too pessimistic. I mean, we began this, and it's true what you said, that we've all been, I think, those of us who watch these things, very shocked by not seeing a big working class response to this crisis. But look at California. In California, an independent, I don't think it's an independent, but the technical workers union there, I think it's about 25,000 workers in the university system, called a general strike at the university over the economic issues. Other unions all over California have been involved in big strikes, demonstrations, and so on, just exactly the kind of different kind of social mobilization of workers than in an industrial workplace, but a tremendous upheaval is taking place in California in contradiction to the rest of the country, you know. The highest levels of unionization are now, I believe, found in the Pacific Northwest, quite contrary to what we think, you know. And I think that on the West Coast you have a different situation. You also have a different political consciousness formed by a region of the country where, for example, gay liberation struggles for gay and lesbian right to marry and so on have affected political consciousness. And I think that we don't always think of it, but working class consciousness, if it's effective, can't simply be a consciousness about workers' issues. It has to be a consciousness that's broader. So I think we'd be too pessimistic if we didn't look at California, which is at the moment an exception, and say that there's more potential out there. The working class does have power when it moves. It can have a big effect on society. It can create new kinds of political forms. We see that taking place in some other countries where we see a new kind of a new left political party, like the new anti-capitalist party in France, say, is appearing. And I know Europe's a different world, but nonetheless, it seems to me, I'm not for giving up hope. In any case, what percentage is there in giving up hope? I mean, even if the working class doesn't have quite the same power the character did before, it's still important to organize people to fight for a more democratic society and a better life.
That was the historian and labor journalist Dan Labatz. Let's take a break, and we'll be back to talk about families today. This is WBAI in New York, 99.5 on the FM dial, and on the web at WBAI.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. We'll be fundraising pretty soon, but if you visit that website in the meanwhile, please hit the donate button and juice up our not-so-juicy cash flow. Was some of the Gang of Four's reflection on the politics of domestic life, contract. The other day, the New York Times had an interesting piece on how many married couples these days consist of a wife who's making more than her husband, and in some cases, a wife who's working while her husband isn't working at all. Time was, that would have been a recipe for intense marital discord. It seems not to be anymore. Here's the excellent historian of family life, Stephanie Kuntz, to talk about all that, and a lot of other things as well. Kuntz is a professor of history at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, and research director of the Council on Contemporary Families. She's the author of The Way We Never Were, American Families and the Nostalgia Trap, first published in 1992, and most recently, Marriage, a History, From Obedience to Intimacy, or How Love Conquered Marriage, that from 2005. Her book, A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and the Wives of the Greatest Generation, will be forthcoming from Basic Books late this year. Welcome, Stephanie. The newspaper of record, which will at least exist for a little while longer, tells us that marriages in which she is working and maybe making more than her husband are actually fairly happy. What accounts for this?
Well, you know, marriage has changed so much in the last 40 years that all of the rules that sociologists used to think applied to marriage are changing. For example, back in the 1950s, if you were a woman who really wanted a stable marriage, the best thing you could do was pick a man who had very conventional ideas about gender roles, and you knew he was going to stick to providing for you, and you certainly couldn't provide for yourself. But today, it's actually men with the most conventional gender roles who are most likely to divorce, or perhaps to be divorced by women whose ideas have changed. Let me give you a couple more examples. In 15, 20 years ago, when a woman in a marriage who wasn't working took a job, that really raised the chances of marital dissolution. She may have been taking it in order to get the independence to get out. Today, when such a woman takes a job, it actually stabilizes the marriage. And marriages where one person does all the domestic work and the other does all the breadwinning are now less stable than marriages that where that's shared. So I think we're getting, now that doesn't mean there aren't some problems in marriages, but the older you are when you marry, the more stable they are. And now that most men and women are looking for different things. Men, you know, having a good cook used to be higher than having someone you could talk to for men's marital choices. Now it's gone way down. For women, two-thirds of college women in 1967 said they'd consider marrying someone they didn't love if he could offer them financial security. Now what they want is communication, sensitivity to their feelings, and, really important now, sharing the housework. So those are the things that tend to make these shared marriages more happy. The ones where the woman earns more are not necessarily happier than the ones where they earn about equal or even as low as 60-40. But certainly the old male breadwinner marriage is not only economically less feasible than it used to be, but it's emotionally less satisfying.
What, if anything, do we know about the prominence of these more egalitarian marriages? What's the share of the traditional versus this new model?
Well, you know, men have tripled the amount of child care they've done in the last 30 years and more than doubled the amount of housework. We still haven't reached equality. Women do tend to do more than men, and particularly they tend to be the ones who consider themselves responsible, so they kind of carry out the executive functioning. But on the other hand, we have seen this tremendous increase in men's participation, and 30% of women now say that their husbands actually do more housework or childcare than they do. In terms of the breadwinning, women still earn less than men, but now 22% of men are married to women who earn more. Actually, that exaggerates how much women's prominence is, because over the course of their lifetime, many of these women will earn less because it's still women who tend to take more time off. But the point is we're moving toward more egalitarian marriages, and the increase in women's wages, contrary to Rush Limbaugh et al., has not come at the expense of men's. However, the women's movement has allowed women to make ground from back in 1960s and early 70s when they were just paid terrible wages. And it's that equalization of women's wages that has only partly compensated for, and unfortunately sometimes masked, the stagnation in men's wages. But how that translates out in families now is so different from the Great Depression, when women went to work and there was a lot of hostility about it. By this time, men and women alike have had 20 years of experience of recognizing that it's women's work that often means the difference between standing still and moving forward a little bit in your living standards, and there's much more acceptance of that. And I think that, again, translates into different expectations of marriage.
How did this develop over time? I think, as I recall, the early days of second wave feminism in the 1970s, there was a lot of tension over these changing roles, and now things have seemed to have stabilized. How did this happen over the last 30 years or so?
Well, I think the main thing is that men have begun to catch up. I think when women first moved into the workforce en masse in the 70s, men immediately did not respond. For example, a lot of people think that women's entry into the workforce has led to a decline in parents' time with children. Actually, today, both men and women spend more time with their children, interacting with their children, than they did back in 1965 at the height of the male breadwinner family. But during the initial 10 or 15 years, there was a decline. What we found was that when women entered the workforce, they did decrease their hours with their kids, and the men did not increase their hours. As late as 1980, you couldn't tell if a man's wife was working, he didn't do more work around the house. Now, that has changed immensely. And I think it's that catching up on the part of men that has tended to stabilize marriage and is the reason, for example, that college-educated and more egalitarian marriages are the ones where the divorce rate has fallen the most. Most people don't realize the divorce rate has actually fallen since 1979 to 81.
And you attribute that to this more egalitarian marriage?
Well, I think it's a couple of things. I think, yes, it's all bound up with, first of all, the increasing importance of marriage to men as well as women financially. It's also bound up with the more egalitarianism of the couples who marry. But it's also bound up, I think, with the increasing age at first marriage, which is complexly tied into and related to the increasing education of women. But, you know, today, every year that a woman delays marriage up until her early 30s decreases her chance of divorce. And even when she delays it more than that, it doesn't increase again. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that modern marriage, unlike the marriages that you see in Mad Men or, you know, that many people experienced in the 60s, where it was just a question of the woman following the man's need because she needed to and that was the social expectation. Now marriages are based on negotiation and people come to them with equal experience. Sometimes often when there's a difference, the woman does earn more or has higher education. These marriages have to be negotiated. And I think both education and an older age make such negotiation more easy for people. Well, maybe not more easy. Negotiation's hard, but at least it allows for a better outcome.
Yeah, you've touched on this a bit, but I want to draw it out some more. What about education and class in relation to these marriage models? Is there some sort of correlation?
Well, of course, you know, and in fact, one of the sad things over the past 20 years is that even though despite the increase in education, you're getting a bigger gap in the likelihood that people from the top 20% will go to college and those from the bottom 20% will either not go or drop out at a very early. So one thing that a college education stands in for, as you know far better than I as an economist with your economics training, is that these couples have more stable incomes. And that, of course, is a help to marriage, too, because chronic economic stress erodes all relationships. It erodes the ability of give and take. It erodes the, you know, sometimes we talk in marriage about the economy of gratitude that makes a good marriage run. People forget to compliment each other on what's going well when they're under economic stress, and they forget to parent their kids well. So, of course, the economic and the education is bound together.
And, of course, talking about this and, of course, the debate over same-sex marriage, a lot of that revolves around notions of traditional marriage. You, of course, are famous for a book, The Way We Never Were. Just give us the précis of this idea of traditional marriage. Was this, the traditional values stuff really rooted in reality, or is it a fantasy projected backwards?
Oh, my goodness. I always am so amused when people tell me that traditional marriage was one man, one woman, because when you look through history and across cultures, the single most preferred form of marriage through the ages, and the one mentioned in the first five books of the Old Testament, is one man, many women. And there have been all sorts of variations. There have been some where a woman married men, many men. There have been also marriages even because through most of history, marriage wasn't an alliance between a man and a woman to just protect their children. It was an alliance between families. It was a way of getting advantageous in-laws. So there have been all sorts of forms of marriage that were designed to include that, including sometimes same-sex marriages, although they weren't common in history, but also things like ghost marriage, where if you and I had engaged our children at an early age because we wanted an alliance and one of them died, we would marry the son or the daughter to the ghost of the spouse that died and still end up relatives. So there have been tremendous variations in history, and a couple of other misconceptions. First of all, that co-breadwinner families are new. Actually, throughout most of history, men and women shared the labor that kept a family going, and there was no such idea as a male breadwinner family. That's something that really only developed over the last 150 years as an ideal, and only predominated in America for a brief 20-year period following World War II. So there's just myths and myths and myths. Another one about same-sex marriage is that procreation and ability to have children should be what makes a marriage valid. Actually, Christianity was the first religion to overturn that, because when Jesus forbade divorce for men as well as women, he had to take the position that the next position that they took was that you could no longer divorce a wife or take a second wife just because she couldn't bear a child. So Christianity pioneered the idea that that the validity of a marriage had nothing to do with whether you could produce children or not. Now, if you could, they told you to go ahead and do that and multiply, but there was nothing in that. So when same-sex couples demand the right to marry, they're actually following one part of the Christian tradition quite well.
I'm speaking with Stephanie Kuntz, who's a professor of history at Evergreen College and also a director of research for the Council on Contemporary Families. Now, it's also a fact that divorce rates are highest in the Bible Belt and lower in the supposedly godless states like Massachusetts and New York. What do you attribute that to?
I think that comes back to what we were talking about that's always a zinger that you can use when people say, oh my goodness, for if Tiger Woods would become Christian, as one politician did, he wouldn't have these affairs. So you can always say, that's interesting. The Bible Belt has more divorce. I think a little piece of it may be connected to religion, and that is in fundamentalist religions or religions that really, really, really frown on premarital sex, that encourages the kids to marry at an earlier age to get their sex. And we all know that early marriage is a huge risk for divorce. But I think much more important is that the Bible Belt is also the place where there's the lowest educational levels and very higher rates of poverty. And these, of course, increase divorce rates.
A writer for the American Prospect, Garance Franz Rudeau, said a couple of years ago that traditional values is largely aspirational. I know the political expression of traditional values is largely aspirational because the people who express these wishes see that the better off, better educated do have more stable marriages and more stable lives, and they sort of are trying to embrace it through these intentions. Do you think there's anything to that?
I think that's a good point to that, and especially, you look at these happy ending movies that are the romance and the sitcoms where the marriages are working, and these are all middle class people, so it's like, perhaps if my family lived like that, I could actually have this kind of success in the world. We saw this back in the 1950s and 60s with the sitcoms, too, that people would watch those and think, oh, this is the way, this is the route to success in American society. But in fact, of course, there is a tremendous contradiction in American values, and Andy Cherlin talks about this in his new book. He makes the point that Americans romanticize marriage more than almost any other European Western country, but they also romanticize individualism and individual choice more. And he quotes one poll where, one page into the poll, you know, 80% of American people say, oh my goodness, marriage is sacred and should not be dissolved for any reason. And then two pages later in the poll, you know, half of the people who said that disagree with the statement that parents should stay together for the sake of the kids if they're unhappy. And we, so we hold these contradictory values.
Well, how do our marriage and divorce rates compare with Western European countries? We spent a lot of time professing the importance of it. How do we stack up?
We have higher marriage rates, and we actually marry earlier. We divorce more, but we remarry more, and we repartner more. And so there is a kind of, for all of our romanticization of the stability of marriage, much more instability in relationships in the United States than in most Western countries. For example, in most of the Scandinavian countries, much lower rates of marriage, much higher rates of cohabitation and unwed births, but they're to cohabiting couples. And a child born to an unmarried couple there actually, on average, lives longer with his or her biological parents than a child born to a married couple in America. And I think a lot of us are beginning to believe that it's that instability and what Cherlin calls churning in relationships that is the real problem for kids. A stable single-parent family is not half so much of a problem as that constant turnover in search of the perfect relationship.
It sounds like our labor market, much more instability and impermanence and insecurity. Well, is there a connection? I mean, is it that the economic model of competitive individualism and that sort of sink or swim social Darwinist model we live under, how much of an influence does this have on our family patterns?
Well, I'm glad you asked that because it really, I can't prove this, but I strongly believe this from my study of history. I think that one reason we hold so fast to this notion of the sanctity of the family and the aspiration to traditional values and the idea that marriage is the one place where people take care of us is that we have no other place where we think that there are social responsibilities and obligations. It's a dog-eat-dog world everywhere else. We are much less likely than the Europeans to believe that there are legitimate areas of social life and economic life that should be subject to some regulation. But on the other hand, you know, basically Americans are nice people. We don't want people to, you know, kids to be thrown out on the street. So what we do is we take all of our desire for stability and obligation and commitment and we pile it onto marriage. That's the only place. In marriage, everything. Outside marriage, nothing. But of course, that's the other problem. When you put that much pressure on a single relationship and institution, it's going to blow up at times. It's a pressure cooker approach to marriage and family. So I think you're quite right that there is a very interesting connection.
Some years ago, there was a big controversy over whether women with good jobs and high levels of education were toxic to the marriage market, and that women who are well off and making a good living are much less likely to get married than they are to get hit by lightning and such. What's the truth on that?
Well, based, again, on old statistics, you know, I've just finished interviewing a lot of women from the 1950s and 60s for a new book I'm doing on why the feminine mystique appealed to a certain layer of women. And I can't tell you how many of those women told me that they wanted to go to college or they wanted to go on after college, and their parents refused to help them. They said, you're pricing yourself out of the marriage market. Back in 1950, the difference in the marriage rates of college graduates and non-college graduates was quite stunning. And so if you went to college, and especially if you pursued higher education and a good job, it was less likely that you would marry. Now, here's an interesting paradox that some people, journalists, have had their trouble wrapping their mind around. There is still a slightly higher chance that a woman who goes on to complete college or goes on to higher education will remain single all her life than her counterparts with less education, whether that's because she can't marry or because she chooses not to marry, we can debate. But here's the interesting point, that when they do marry, they marry at a later age, and when they do marry, their divorce rates are so much lower than their counterparts that by age 40, a higher proportion of college-educated women are married than the lower-educated women, because even though more of those women married, more of those women are now divorced. And the Council on Contemporary Families just had Betsy Stevenson from UPenn run a very interesting series of statistics about this. The other thing that she showed that interested me is that in terms of your chance of marrying, if you want to marry, over age 40, college-educated women have much greater chance of being able to marry at an older age than women with less education. So yes, it may be that there are that some women do run out of time for having a baby or don't manage to get married. But actually, your best choice, chance, I think, for a satisfying life, either a stable marriage or a satisfying single life, because by the time they reach their 50s, these women are almost just as happy as happily married women, just a slight very difference, and they're much more happier than divorced women. I think the idea of sticking in there and not rushing into the early marriage and allowing popular culture to panic you is by far the best course.
The other news spasm in recent times was that women with coming out of elite colleges with high levels of education are withdrawing from the labor market and becoming stay-at-home moms. Is there any truth to that?
Well, a kernel of truth in terms of a blip in the long-run trend toward women being in the labor market. You know, some of these things are so anti-historical. What do you think these women were doing in the 60s and 70s? They weren't going to the labor market at all. They were just staying home. Certainly, having a child increases a woman's chance of dropping out of the labor force for a little while. But it increases it today much less than it did back in 1980. As Heather Boucher from the Center for American Progress has shown, the influence of a child on a woman's dropping out of work is much less than it used to be. Having said that, there was an uptick in the late 1990s, and some people attribute this to a move to opt out. I actually think that it had more to do with the real increase in work hours for high-earning men. And there are some studies that I know of that suggest that it's the number of a husband's work hours that is a better predictor of a woman dropping out of the labor force than actually whether she has a child or not. And the final thing you have to bear in mind when you hear about all this stuff about elite women opting out is actually the only segment of the labor force where stay-at-home moms are a majority are in those women who are married to men in the lowest 25% of the earnings capacity. Then when you get up to the top 5%, that's the second highest, but still a majority of those mothers are in the labor force. And when you get in the middle tiers, about 70% of those mothers are in the labor force. So this opt-out phenomenon, I don't know, you know, who was on helium or what, but it just doesn't accurately capture what's been going on. Now, what it may accurately capture is the tremendous anxiety that we all feel about trying to have a dual earner marriage in a situation where our policymakers and our work leaders still assume that every worker has a wife at home to take care of life, and that's tremendously stressful. So we may fantasize about dropping out. And by the way, men are now even more likely than women to report high levels of work-family conflict. But the dropout, and when people do drop out, here's my final point, they do want to come back. This idea that there's a mommy wars between people who want to stay home and people who want to work is just wrong. Sylvia Hewlett did an interesting study which showed that most of the women who did drop out to have children intended to go back to work within a few years and then, unfortunately, found tremendous difficulty in doing so.
Yeah, you sort of anticipated my last question, which is, has policy, whether we're talking government or employer, really caught up to the world of the new family that we're living in?
Absolutely not. I mean, I would say we had Neanderthal, except that now it appears from recent research that that would, that would be maligning the Neanderthals. But, you know, our school hours were 100 years out of date, designed for when kids had to be home to work with to help with the milking. Policies in healthcare, you know, are just completely out of step with everything in the Western European society. And our work hours and work policies and parental leave policies are completely shocking. The United States and Australia are the only major industrial countries that don't have guaranteed paid parental leave or maternal leave. But at least in Australia, you get a year off without pay. In the U.S., you're only entitled to, I believe it's 8 weeks, and only about half of American workers are entitled to do that, to take that. And of those, many of the companies actually ignore the law and get away with it because it's not enforced.
That was Stephanie Kuntz, professor of history at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, and the research and education director of the Council on Contemporary Families. She's the author of The Way We Never Were, American Families in a Nostalgia Trap, first published in 1992, and most recently of Marriage, a History, from 2005. Her book, A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and the Wives of the Greatest Generation, will be forthcoming from Basic Books late this year. The website of the Council on Contemporary Families, of which Stephanie Kuntz is research director, is a rich storehouse of information on marriage, families, and children, and is a bracing antidote to all the nonsense people utter on this topic. It's at contemporaryfamilies.org. That's contemporaryfamilies, all one word, .org. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Vampire Weekend's Holiday from their new album. Yeah, Vampire Weekend. So shoot me for being a plaything of the zeitgeist. Bye.